is time to get started. Thanks for attending session 356. My name is Natalie, and I'll be moderating the session. It is titled William Bickerton versus Brigham Young, the case against polygamy. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session, following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded. You'll be able to purchase it after the presentation out at the registration desk. You can also purchase Sunstone magazine. If you purchase it here, you get 7 issues for the price of 6. Also, they have Skull Candy official headstone, or sorry, headphones, not headstones. Ooh, sorry, not yet. Those are coming. Skull Candy headphones customized for Sunstone. And it says your support goes directly to keeping Symposium and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom by Benchmark Books and consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 90 minutes long. We ask that the audience and presenters keep within the framework of time so that we can allow the next session to start on time. And when we're finished, please clear out quickly so that the next session can start on time. Sometime in late 1851 or early 1852, Brigham Young decided to publicly endorse plural marriage. While attending a church meeting in Allegheny City, Pennsylvania, William Bickerton, a dedicated Mormon elder, heard the shocking news. He arose from his seat and declared, "If the approval of God were to come to me by accepting the doctrine of polygamy, I would prefer the displeasure of God." The session will explore why Bickerton challenged polygamy and why this dramatic event prompted him to forsake Brigham Young and establish a new church. Daniel Stone has a BA and MA in history. He's written the first full-length biography on William Bickerton, which is forthcoming from Signature Books. He works in a private archive in the Detroit metro area and has taught at Florida Atlantic University and the University of Detroit Mercy. D. Michael Quinn is an affiliated scholar at the University of Southern California's Center for Feminist Research. He has been a full-time researcher and writer, a professor of history at Brigham Young University, and a visiting professor of history at Yale. His accolades include Best Book Awards from the American Historical Association and the Mormon History Association. We are grateful to have both of them here, and we'll turn the time over.
All right. Thank you very much. It's good to see all of you. I know there's a lot of heavy-hitting discussions going on right now, so the fact that you came to mine, really appreciate it. You're probably just here to see Michael Quinn, and I'm okay with that, too. So, having the Leonard J. Arrington Award winner for this year is pretty humbling, to say the least. Okay, so about William Bickerton. William Bickerton is the founding prophet of the third largest Latter-day Saint church in the world, believe it or not. I know, I was shocked about that too. I actually just checked the numbers last year. I got the official church numbers from the church secretary. It is a little over 22,000 worldwide right now, which basically puts it up, from what I count, as the third largest. The restoration branches, mostly in Independence, Missouri, and kind of other areas, are cutting it close to that, but they're not a unified church as the Church of Jesus Christ is. So, William Bickerton, who is he? Why are we even talking about him? Well, it's actually, I think it's pretty important to talk about him because not only is he the founding prophet of the third largest church, but if you think about, or third largest Latter-day Saint church, but if you think about it, he is one of the only people that is an outsider that claims a direct descent to the original church. So think about it. He's a contemporary of Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, James Jesse Strang, and all the other, Joseph Smith III, the Hedrickites. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And yet, here's this guy who joins Sidney Rigdon's church. He's an English immigrant, and then he joins Brigham Young's church, and then he completely makes a whole new church. Well, it basically trying to tie his roots back to Joseph Smith, and he claims a divine manifestation that told him to do so. And it's pretty significant. And believe it or not, there's, out of all the names I told you, there's countless books written about all these men. And there's not one book written about William Bickerton. Not one. and which is shocking. And there's only, from what I've seen, two professional journal articles. One was in the Journal of Mormon History, and one was in Kansas History. So it's long overdue, and unfortunately, you're stuck with me doing it. So, so without further ado, I'll get started. Well, before I took on the hotter, more cool profession of history, I used to be in a rock band, so I used to be able to dance around and stuff. But now I'm stuck doing this, so I'm going to try to animate my voice and pretend I'm still on stage to kind of go back to my old age. So forgive me if I get a little animated. All right. It is no surprise that William Bickerton eventually sought out Brigham Young. After the death of Joseph Smith, Young succeeded where Signe Rigdon had failed. Back in June 1845, Bickerton, who was a poor English immigrant, joined Rigdon's Church of Christ in Pittsburgh. Under Rigdon's tutelage, Bickerton received ordinations as an elder, evangelist, and prophet, priest, and king. During his short stint with the Church of Christ, Bickerton had been promised a crown in the millennium, and the Book of Mormon had introduced an apostolic Christianity that he had never known. Within a matter of months, Bickerton rose above his poverty to receive glorious spiritual wealth. But alas, by May 1846, Bickerton became disenchanted with Rigdon. Rigdon attempted to build the New Jerusalem in the Cumberland Valley of Pennsylvania, and fortuitously, Bickerton chose not to take part. Within a matter of months, Rigdon's Zionic enterprise went bankrupt. Afterward, Bickerton found himself alone, without a church, consoling those who lost their finances in the pursuit of Zion. Bickerton witnessed firsthand the liability of Rigdon's erratic behavior and felt obliged to aid those who lost their finances in the Cumberland Valley. After the downfall of Rigdon's New Jerusalem, from late 1847 to mid-1851, Bickerton's writings are almost silent as to what occurred. It is not certain how many followers initially came to him when Rigdon escaped Pennsylvania. However, what is clear is that Bickerton was unable to foster his small congregation. He maintained his convictions in the restored gospel, but he needed ecclesiastical stability. Brigham Young, the religious pioneer who had established a haven for the Mormons in the Great Basin of the Salt Lake Valley, eventually appeared as a viable partner to champion God's latter-day work. This feeling, though, would not so last. To Bickerton's utter surprise, Brigham Young would soon become his greatest rival. When news reached Bickerton that Brigham Young was secretly practicing polygamy, he determined to expose what he considered the Mormon prophet's heresy. By 1850, it seemed that Brigham Young received favor from heaven. He had courageously led his people on an exodus west, then established a commercial oasis in the desert. Gold swelled the church's coffers, and Mormons helped find the first flakes in California. To curb worldly lusts, Young warned his people not to chase riches. U.S. President Millard Fillmore supported Young's leadership, while American sentiments toward the saints began to soften. In 1847, the Pittsburgh Gazette commented how the Mormon journey into northern Mexico presented a scene incomparable to any other in American history. The editorial announced, "We have noticed for several weeks past various parties of immigrants to the west passing through this city. An unusual portion of them are well-dressed, intelligent persons from the eastern states. We think they are the most substantial persons who have gone west for a long time. We have noticed none, apparently, in better circumstances. To our surprise, a gentleman who has every opportunity of knowing assures us the great majority of them are Mormons." The news astonished Pittsburgh locals, and the report ironically appeared just as Rigdon's New Jerusalem was collapsing. At this time, Bickerton stood at a crossroad and did not know which way to venture. Then, over the next 3 years, Young prospered in the West. With this news, his suspicions, like those of so many other Americans, subsided. Sometime in 1850, Bickerton sent an inquiry to Canesville, Iowa, requesting information about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Canesville, the Iowan section of Winter Quarters, converted into a city, later part of Council Bluffs, in 1848. Soon after, John Murray and David James Ross, two itinerant Mormon elders, received Bickerton's request. In 1851, the pair met his small congregation of 9 members in West Elizabeth, Pennsylvania. Upon their arrival, the missionaries held a meeting with Bickerton's group, where both parties presented their beliefs, concerns, and questions. Bickerton probably did not encounter staunch demands or strict stipulations from Ross and Murray. They most likely listened to his concerns, including his doctrinal differences. The pair understood that he had originally received instruction under Sidney Rigdon and probably displayed sensitivity to the alienation and hardships he had suffered. They may have even identified with Bickerton's feelings, since he, along with Brigham Young, had resisted Rigdon's quest for power. Both parties shared important similarities. Ross and Murray, like the 12 apostles, sustained that the Mormons did not practice polygamy. The duo lied to Bickerton, but their confirmation refuted Sidney Rigdon's accusation that Joseph Smith had fallen into apostasy by introducing the practice. This admission pleased Bickerton. Therefore, he and the missionaries supported the notion that Smith had maintained his prophetic office before his death. Although Bickerton did not mention which books his congregation used, they most likely read from the Bible, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, and Book of Moses. Members of the Church of Christ had esteemed all 4 texts, and there is no reason to suggest that Bickerton did not use them after he had disbanded from Rigdon. Brigham Young's church reverenced the books as well, so the doctrinal foundation between both groups nearly corresponded. Bickerton also believed in baptism for the dead, since Rigdon's church had observed the practice. In addition, he affirmed that God gave revelations to worthy individuals, a fundamental concept at the basis of Mormonism. Bickerton further believed that the Lord intervened in human affairs. At this time, he never wrote whether he believed men ascended to the status of godhood in the afterlife, but this idea permeated in Mormonism since Joseph Smith's King Follett sermon in 1844. Consequently, it is possible that he considered the veracity of that precept. And paramount to both groups' convictions, Bickerton and the Latter-day Saints believed that Jesus Christ's second coming was imminent. John Murray and David James Ross baptized William Bickerton, his wife Dorothy, and his 8 other followers in the Monongahela River. Bickerton's congregation required the same renewed dedication that the saints had received when they reached the Salt Lake Valley. Then on Sunday, May 25th, the missionaries organized a branch of the Latter-day Saints in West Elizabeth at the home of William Thews. Ross and Murray confirmed the members by laying their hands on each person's head and offering a prayer. In their appeal, they asked the Lord to give the Holy Ghost to each convert. The duo understood that some members of the branch had followed Bickerton since 1847. Whether the Mormon Church recognized him as a prophet or not, they knew the West Elizabeth congregation's loyalty remained with him. So during the meeting, Ross and Murray conducted ordinations. They called Bickerton as an elder and appointed him as the presiding minister of the branch. Bickerton, at last, received the assistance he desperately needed. The future now seemed bright. He could continue to accomplish the work he felt God called him to do, to preach the restored gospel, to save souls, and to prepare the world for the millennium. Bickerton's efforts prospered his small congregation. In July, 5 members received ordinations: William Thews as an elder, and Thomas Innes, Robert Russell, Martin Wardell, and George Rain as priests. By September, his branch had tripled in membership. He claimed 27 members at the month's conference. Bickerton must have basked in euphoria. He found success and stability preaching under Brigham Young. It appeared to him the Latter-day Saints were building the kingdom of God on earth. During the conference, he led motions to sustain Brigham Young, his counselors, and the quorum of 12 apostles in their offices. John Murray, who presided over the meeting, reinforced Bickerton's elation when he delivered a sermon on the rise and prosperity of the church in spite of all opposition. The success of the West Elizabeth, McKeesport, and Youghiogheny branches encouraged the members to publish their conference minutes in the Frontier Guardian, the church newspaper in Canesville. Bickerton also wanted to show his gratitude to John Murray and David James Ross. At the end of the conference, the West Elizabeth branch issued a note of thanks, acknowledging their indebtedness to the duo's commitment. For a brief moment, Bickerton found peace. It seemed his ministerial troubles were over. Nevertheless, his contentment would quickly disappear. Sometime in late 1851 or early 1852, Brigham Young decided to publicly endorse plural marriage. He had already told the Utah Saints in early 1851 that he practiced polygamy, but now he wanted to make or alter the church's policy and make the doctrine official. He planned to acknowledge as well as defend the tenet. By this period, accounts of plural marriage had reached a wide audience. In 1851, a Mormon named Frederick Cox received an order from the Iowa courts in Canesville to abandon his two youngest wives. In early 1852, an expose written by an ex-Mormon appeared in the Lehigh Register of Eastern Pennsylvania that manifested the licentiousness run mad in Utah. Although Young withheld his official announcement of plural marriage until a special conference in August 1852, traveling Mormon officials publicized the doctrine earlier in the year. While attending a church meeting in Allegheny City, now the north side of Pittsburgh, William Bickerton heard the shocking news. To prepare the saints in the east for Young's August announcement, church officials informed the assembly that if they promptly accepted the doctrine of plural marriage, they would receive God's approval. On the other hand, if they denounced the practice, they would accept damnation. The announcement astounded some while confirmed the suspicion of others. For Bickerton, it disconcerted his feelings and his anger ensued. The previous year, John Murray and David James Ross had assured him the church did not practice polygamy. Now he realized that he had naively placed his trust in Mormon missionaries who had candidly lied to his face. Did a man's word, Bickerton may have wondered, especially one who claimed to hold the priesthood, mean nothing? After all, Ross and Murray would have known of the precept. Mormons had practiced plural marriage in Canesville since the first wagons arrived in 1846. After hearing the announcement, Bickerton arose from his seat and stood among the congregation, many of whom knew him personally. Then he declared, "If the approval of God were to come to me by accepting the doctrine of polygamy, I would prefer the displeasure of God." He proceeded to walk out of the meeting, displaying his defiance to the entire assembly. It did not matter to him what the crowd thought. At that moment, he abandoned the church. The man who more than doubled his Mormon congregation the prior year vowed to never return to the Latter-day Saints. On Wednesday, March 10th, he informed the West Elizabeth branch of the news. When he stood in front of the congregation, he boldly declared that he forsook the Mormons. Bickerton then tried to convince the members to do the same. He penned an affidavit that stated, "We, the undersigned, have left off all connection whatsoever with Brigham Young and the 12, whose headquarters or home is the valley of the Great Salt Lake, because of their adultery and general wickedness." However, no one signed the statement. The congregation was probably shocked to hear the report, especially since their presiding elder had already decided to leave the church. They may have discussed the proceedings of the Allegheny City meeting, or the congregation wanted to examine the evidence for themselves. After all, in the minds of Latter-day Saints, when a Mormon transferred their church membership, they did more than join another faith. They abandoned the restored gospel and dissented from the truth. This single act assured one's damnation. Bickerton felt comfortable proclaiming he preferred God's condemnation rather than to endorse polygamy. But to others, this decision may have been harder to accept. If the congregation chose to defy Brigham Young, they would challenge his prophetic office. Unlike Bickerton, the membership did not want to act hastily. As scheduled, Young held a special conference on August 29th. He asked Apostle Orson Pratt, one of the church's best intellectuals, to prepare the official announcement for plural marriage. More than a mere affirmation of the doctrine, the declaration presented a stunning defense. Pratt began by asserting that marriage provided individuals an opportunity to share in the plan of salvation. He stated, "The Lord ordained marriage between male and female as a law through which spirit should come here and take tabernacles and enter into the second state of existence. The Lord himself solemnized the first marriage pertaining to this globe." Pratt declared that all humans existed in a spirit form before they received a body on earth. Since God had a body and wanted to fashion people into a similar form, the Lord created the institution of marriage. When a couple conceived, God placed a spirit into a body. The Lord had fathered children in the heavens, Brigham Young taught, then created the earth so the spirits could inhabit tabernacles of clay, where they could mature, learn morality, and have a free will to choose good over evil. Mormon men had the same opportunity. As Joseph Smith had previously instructed, the Lord allowed men of the priesthood, who were married for eternity, to become gods in the afterlife. When a married man died, his soul achieved godhood. Like Jesus Christ, a man's soul conformed to the Father's will, who shared his will with the higher gods. The heavens held a hierarchy of celestial beings whose minds were interconnected. As Young instructed, a resurrected saint would organize an earth, people it, redeem it, and sanctify it. Gods rose to a higher position when earthly kingdoms from other worlds were presented to them, and as rising souls below them achieved godhood status. Having family relations is what increased a man's eternal glory. A man who sealed his marriage for eternity could procreate on earth and in the heavens. The more children he had, the greater number of kingdoms he could receive, thus achieving a higher exaltation. This is where the doctrine of plural marriage became an integral part of salvation. Pratt and Brigham Young proclaimed that women increased a man's glory in the afterlife. The more marriages a man had on earth, the more bodies he could procreate to receive a spirit. This allowed his children to have an opportunity to accept salvation in their second estate. His marital relations increased the heritage of the Father and the earthly kingdom of Christ. As a result, God would reward him in eternity. Pratt and Young did not believe a Mormon man had to practice polygamy to become a god, but they did assert that a man could receive a higher exaltation if he consented to the practice. To prove that plural marriage mirrored the ancient customs of the Israelites, Pratt declared that the doctrine followed the divine example the Lord gave humankind. Orson Spencer, a British convert and pamphleteer, supported Pratt's argument in 1853 when he wrote that the family order which God established with Abraham and the patriarchs was the order observed among celestial beings in the celestial world. Pratt and Spencer adopted Joseph Smith's concept that God had a history. At one time, the Lord was a man who had died and resurrected. In the flesh, God married several women who were sealed to him for eternity. When they rose to the heavens, the Lord and his wives conceived spirit children. Therefore, Abraham's multiple marriages emulated the father's familial relationships. Women had a special role in this custom as well. Think about it. In Victorian America, females did not have much status in matrimony, but in plural marriage, Mormon women had the opportunity to become mothers in heaven. Women could give birth to human spirits that would one day inhabit an earthly body in another world. Without them, procreation, families, and the plan of salvation could not continue. As Pratt and Spencer asserted, polygamy linked Mormons to the celestial family order, placing them on a divine stratum higher than the average American. Orson Pratt's argument had deep philosophical and theological connections that wove the Mormon scriptures, Joseph Smith's prophecies, and biblical history into a social code, a system, he declared, that trumped the concepts of Victorian monogamy. He believed polygamy offered an avenue where a numerous and faithful posterity can be raised up and taught in the principles of righteousness and truth. Plural marriage, he thought, gave couples an opportunity to raise more children in a devout household. He believed polygamy interlinked families in a holy environment that, let's face it, in Victorian America, would otherwise have isolated and divided lives. As the United States industrialized, immigrant mothers and fathers had to work really long days, returning home exhausted. To help stave off poverty, working-class households often took in other relatives and boarders. The hard daily routines of industrialized life fragmented the immigrant family. Pratt believed that the middle-class and upper-class families did not fare much better. Wives and children grew apart from the work environment, creating what historians term the cult of domesticity. Although the culture promoted piety among women, it restrained mothers to a lonely life. Housebound females had a responsibility to create a refuge for the husband, a man who often did not understand the needs or personalities of those in his household. Pratt argued these characteristics of American society destroyed the family unit and bred prostitution, orphanages, and runaways. Plural marriage, he claimed, guarded against this injustice by placing families under the umbrella of Mormonism, a religion that founded its principles on God's love and protection. Likewise, the church strictly regulated polygamy, a system the federal government failed to provide for American marriages. Monogamy, Pratt tried to demonstrate, spurred all of society's problems. After the August conference, Brigham Young sent missionaries throughout the United States and Europe to present the doctrine to church branches. He wanted to familiarize Mormons with the institution and have elders defend it against public scrutiny. He expected the federal government to object, so he prepared a defense that he thought Washington could not dispute. Young asserted that the federal government could not deny an institution that was founded in religion. He argued the First Amendment protected plural marriage. There is not a constitution or law in any state in the Union that forbids a man having two wives, he contended, if that man lays it down as a principle of faith or creed. He also crafted his argument on the basis of popular sovereignty. If the federal government could delegate the decision of slavery's growth and propagation to the Western territories, Young thought, Utah's residents should be allowed to choose plural marriage. As for Congress, they might as well abolish slavery in the South as plurality in Utah, he commented. It is absolutely remarkable that William Bickerton did not acquiesce to Brigham Young and Orson Pratt's logic. They presented plural marriage as an essential component of Mormon theology and as a cure for America's social dissolution. Notwithstanding the pair's shrewd presentations, Bickerton held firm convictions about sexuality. His religious background stemmed from Methodism and early Mormonism, which before introducing plural marriage, held similar beliefs about matrimony. Both groups believed Adam and Eve's fall in the Garden of Eden caused humankind to suffer carnal desires. That is why God established the institution of marriage. A man and a woman could have sex, a sexual relationship within the confines of wedlock. Actually, both faiths encouraged marital sex since it fomented couples' one flesh relationship and procreated children. Physical love bound a couple together, creating a representation of the marriage covenant, a family. One sin broke this partnership, adultery. This single transgression, as Jesus Christ stated, broke the marital contract and allowed couples to divorce. Simply put, sex had limits. The Bible and Book of Mormon reserved sexual activity for marriage only. Interestingly, Young and Pratt claimed to follow these same principles. They maintained that polygamous relationships could only occur as marriages. If a man married a second wife under the authority of the Mormon Church, they believed the partnership received God's approval. Bickerton, however, proclaimed this allegation a farce. He understood the Book of Mormon to forbid plural marriage. Jacob, a Book of Mormon prophet who lived in the 6th century BC, chastised the Nephites in his writings for their pride and infidelity. After condemning the first transgression, he told the people about their, quote, grosser crime. Jacob declared, "This people begin to wax in iniquity. They understand not the scriptures, for they seek to excuse themselves in committing whoredoms because of the things which were written concerning David and Solomon, his son." The Mormons believe they continued a righteous custom practiced by the Israelite patriarchs. But as Bickerton pointed out, Jacob criticized these religious luminaries. Writing the word of the Lord, Jacob penned, "Behold, David and Solomon truly had many wives and concubines, which thing was abominable before me, saith the Lord. Wherefore, my brethren, hear me and hearken to the word of the Lord. For there shall not any man among you have, save it be one wife. And concubines he shall have none. For I, the Lord God, delight in the chastity of women, and whoredoms are an abomination before me. Thus saith the Lord of hosts." According to Bickerton, the Book of Mormon clearly stated that polygamy defiled a woman's virtue and branded a man as a fornicator. Plural marriage was, in fact, adultery. Mormons, he thought, ironically called themselves after a book that prohibited the doctrine. This alone proved the church's hypocrisy. To Bickerton, Jacob's words were prophetic. The prophet's message spoke to a time when a group who called themselves the Lord's New Covenant people would proclaim that the scriptures supported polygamy. If Young and Pratt had had the opportunity to counter Bickerton's argument, they probably would have quoted a verse just a few lines ahead. In Jacob's words, God further declared, "For if I will, saith the Lord of hosts, raise up seed unto me, I will command my people. Otherwise, they shall hearken unto these things." The Mormon prophets, Young and Pratt might have countered, had received a commandment from God and executed his will, just as the Book of Mormon stipulated. Joseph Smith recorded the revelation of celestial marriage in 1843, and Brigham Young publicly endorsed the practice 9 years later. But again, Bickerton would have disagreed. He had another interpretation of the verse. For him, God merely stated that if procreation needed to occur, the Lord would arrange marriages rather than have men commit adultery. For example, as the Book of Mormon explains, before Lehi and his family fled Jerusalem for the New World, God commanded that his sons, quote, should take daughters to wife, that they might raise up seed unto the Lord in the land of promise. Lehi's sons had monogamous marriages with the daughters of Ishmael, a family friend. Ultimately, Bickerton thought the Book of Mormon presented clear, forthright instructions about marriage, all of which condemn polygamy. Now, let me take a step back for a second. Bickerton, throughout all his writings, is adamantly saying the Book of Mormon does not in any way, shape, or form support polygamy. He's constantly saying that, and he constantly quotes Jacob's words. But he never brings up that verse about, you know, the stipulation of, like, well, if I command it. So it really begs the question, why on earth does Bickerton keep saying the Book of Mormon in no way, shape, or form condemns polygamy when most Mormons are saying, well, there's a catch? And there's the reason, because as you can see, there's only one place in the Book of Mormon that uses that same exact language as raise up seed unto the Lord. So if you look at the stipulation, it says, if I will, saith the Lord host, raise up seed unto me, I will command my people. And the only place that same exact language is used is talking about monogamous marriages. God commanded Ishmael and Ishmael's daughters to marry Lehi's son. So as you can see, Bickerton really was taking the Book of Mormon literally. After 10 months with Young's Latter-day Saints, just as the Book of Mormon revealed, Bickerton's views towards women complemented Victorian attitudes of the day. The prophet Jacob declared that God delighted in the chastity of women, a popular notion in antebellum America. The Victorian ethic instructed women to maintain a virtuous nature. They had to control sexual urges and learn proper decorum. Similar to the 18th century's concept of republican motherhood, a wife nurtured her children and provided a comfortable home for her husband, isolating herself from the corruptions of society. However, unlike Victorianism, which limited married couples to only occasional sex, Bickerton's religious heritage taught him that an intimate relationship provided a healthy, moral life. He belonged to the working class, a group that commonly had large families. In 1852, he had three small children with another, Claire Virginia, on the way. Despite this exception, Bickerton agreed that women, and men as well, had a responsibility to uphold a respectable character. He disagreed with Orson Pratt that plural marriage surpassed Victorian etiquette. Bickerton's sentiments had changed. Now he preferred Victorian morality over Young's Mormonism. After 10 months of affiliation with Young's Latter-day Saints, Bickerton realized John Murray and David James Ross had represented a false Brigham Young. His earlier suspicions proved true. The Utah Mormons practiced polygamy. He felt violated and deceived. These feelings were sharply reminiscent. 6 years earlier, Bickerton had left Sidney Rigdon when he succumbed to religious extremism. Now he left Brigham Young over the doctrine of plural marriage. Twice he had placed his trust in Mormon leaders, only to depart disappointed. Again, he stood at a personal juncture, unsure where to venture. It is absolutely remarkable that he did not consider returning to Methodism. Still, he proclaimed, I knew my calling was from heaven. Bickerton thought his spiritual dedication had eclipsed his blunder with the Latter-day Saints. Rigdon, despite his failures, had introduced Bickerton to a faith he could not denounce. The Book of Mormon harmonized with the Bible, unfolding glorious promises to Israel and the Gentiles. The text foretold of the second coming and Zion's peaceful onset. Somehow, he determined to take part in the millennium. It is not certain how many members from the West Elizabeth branch rejected Young, but in the end, several returned to Bickerton. To his surprise, he still had a loyal congregation. Their allegiance to the restored gospel gave him hope. As he paused to know what course to follow, one certainty remained. Plural marriage would transform the perception of Mormonism. The religion would become analogous to adultery. Americans would criticize the faith while Washington would oppose the practice of polygamy. Bickerton knew that he had to distance his people from Brigham Young. Therefore, the people of Salt Lake are gone astray, he later testified, and if the Lord had not left us a seed, we should have been as Sodom and like unto Gomorrah. He thought the Lord had redeemed his followers from debauchery. Another would build the kingdom of God, he asserted, a prophet in the room instead of Joseph Smith to lead forth his people, and that man is William Bickerton. Thank you so much.
And And in preface to my remarks, I'll mention that I've printed them out. I graciously got a copy of Daniel Stone's paper, the first of the participants in the symposium who sent me their comments, and I appreciate that, and thank him for that diligence. And I have prepared remarks and have them printed out. There are maybe 8 or so copies here on the table available for those of you who would like copies of them. If you find when you come to the table that the copies have already been taken, just put your email address under the reference to Daniel Stone's paper. And in a few months, I'm not probably going to be able to get back to California for a couple of months, but I'll send an electronic copy of these remarks to you if you're not able to get a copy. I was interested in this paper for 2 reasons. First, during my years of research about the succession crisis that immediately followed the 1844 martyrdom of Mormonism's founding prophet, I never read any of the available histories or documents about William Bickerton. Although he initially followed Sidney Rigdon's post-martyrdom claim to leadership, Bickerton soon led a church that descended from Joseph Smith's one-time counselor. Because my historical interest was primarily in the first claimants of successorship, I ignored Bickerton and had a lot to learn from Daniel Stone's paper. Second, about 6 years ago, I was introduced to someone who grew up in the Church of Jesus Christ that Bickerton founded in Pennsylvania. Lori Winder Stromberg and her husband, Tom, invited me to their house for dinner with a writer from the Los Angeles Times who had this background. I thought I had grown up in a religious minority in Los Angeles, but Ralph Framolino gave us a fascinating narrative of his experiences growing up in the eastern states within a church that also revered the Book of Mormon, yet numbered in the hundreds. Typically, I examine the footnotes first whenever I read an academic essay like Daniel Stone's. I had read only bibliographical references to Bickerton's periodical, The Ensign, and I recognized the name of William H. Cadman as the author of an old history of the Church of Jesus Christ. However, I was pleased to see Stone's citation to a book unknown to me, David Jordan's 2002 History of This Church. Moreover, I was very interested to see his citations from 2 manuscript archives I have never visited, one in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, and another in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Because I knew nothing about Bart Bickerton, everything Stone's presentation said about this early Mormon's experiences and perspectives after 1844 was new to me, as I assume it was to most of those attending this session of the Sunstone Symposium. And I appreciate that contribution to our understanding. However, titled as a comparison of differing views by Bickerton and Brigham Young, Stone's paper is too heavily weighted with the perspectives and quotes from Young and his Utah followers. Stone gives too little space to quoting from his Bickerton sources. On the other hand, leaving his audience eager to learn more is the purpose of all academic presentations. I'm grateful to Daniel Stone for achieving that goal today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I do want to address that. He's absolutely right, and I did do that specifically for that purpose, and I was wondering if someone would point it out, and he did, because actually, in the following chapters, I go way more into detail about Bickerton and polygamy. I'll give you the quick abridged version. Polygamy was a huge issue for Bickerton, and it's talked about throughout the entire rest of the book, so this is just kind of like the teeth to kind of like get you guys interested, because polygamy is interlinked completely with godhood, right? It increases a man's exaltation. It's also connected to baptism for the dead, because that connects families like polygamy does, and it increases exaltation in the afterlife. And even though Bickerton had believed in baptism for the dead, possibly the plurality of gods under Sidney Rigdon and Brigham Young, see, when polygamy comes in later and he's starting to start his own church, he's actually getting rid of not only polygamy, but because of polygamy, he then gets rid of baptism for the dead and the plurality of gods. And that was a whole other topic. So thank you, Michael, for pointing that out. You're totally right. So anyways, I'd love to hear your questions or comments, and please criticize me. That's okay.
So Bickerton does away with those ordinances, but yet he keeps washing of feet. Did he know about the Kirtland?
Yes, he did.
Okay, so he kept that. Now, why do you think he kept that? Well, because it didn't have anything to do with Godhead, right?
Yeah, with that, yeah, that had to do with like sealings and anointings and the, you know, in the Kirtland Temple, and later on that ordinance has it. Bickerton was a real literalist as he grew on later in his life, and he just read the verse in St. John's epistle about washing of feet, and how Jesus said, "If you don't do this, you have no part with me." And mm-hmm. William Bickerton was like, "Well, we're going to do it." So the way he did it in his church was it's a simple ordinance. They actually do it in their buildings. There's no temple that they do it in, and they just the men wash the men's feet and the women wash the women's feet. And it was just an ordinance of humility. And while you're washing their feet, you pray for the people that you're washing.
Daniel, thank you very much, too, for the excellent presentation. That's about the highest compliment you can ever get, is teaching Mike Quinn something new. So that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks so much, Daniel. My question is a little bit about William Bickerton in terms of, I'm curious if he was... Because in Mormonism, a lot of times there's a lionization of leaders and people in power and really putting them up on a pedestal. And I'm curious if William Bickerton gained a lot more respect among his followers for being so against polygamy, and if that changed his relationship in his authority position compared to Brigham Young's authority position, if there were differences there.
Oh, these are great questions. Yeah, absolutely. That's an excellent point. Yeah, that did raise him up to a higher level, because the fact that he stood up to Brigham Young. I don't have any evidence to see that Brigham Young and William Bickerton actually met. I mean, for as far as we're concerned, I mean, Brigham Young was out in the West doing his own thing. William Bickerton was probably just a minor footnote in the back of his mind. So, but Bickerton, the fact that he stood up to two Mormon leaders really raised him, and eventually Bickerton is officially, I mean, they had always considered him as a prophet, his followers, but later on in 1859 he's actually ordained a prophet, even though they had already considered him as such. But Bickerton was really unique, because like a lot of restoration branches, you only have one prophet that leads the church, right? And he's the president. Bickerton actually acknowledged that he was not the only person that could be a prophet. There were other men in his church that were considered prophets, and women as well were considered prophetesses. He was very egalitarian in that sense. He's really kind of weird in that way, because women and men during conference, like, you know, they're having regular conference discussing what's going to happen, and all of a sudden a woman in the conference, she's allowed to be there, will stand up and speak in tongues and then have the interpretation, and it might be instructing the people to do something. And if it confirmed with the Bible and Book of Mormon, usually the membership in the ministry in Bickerton would be like, all right, let's do it. So, I mean, he was really weird. And I will bring this up. This is a really good example. Bickerton was not a perfect, no man or woman is perfect. You know, they always, any leader in any leadership position always abuses their power. That's just history and that's life. But Bickerton was really unique in the sense that there's this one instance I talk about in the book. They're debating whether they're going to excommunicate somebody, because his name was Jacob Stranger. And we don't know what Jacob Stranger did according to the church minutes, but we do know that he did do something wrong that was worth excommunication. And they're in the meeting ready to kind of figure out what's going to happen. And all of a sudden, William Bickerton gets up and speaks the word of the Lord. And he's the one leading the meeting of this excommunication. And he speaks the word of the Lord, and I'll paraphrase, but the Lord actually says through him, according to Bickerton, "All of you are fallible, and any of you can fall away. So don't judge Jacob Stranger for making a mistake that he's repentant of. You accept him back into my church." So you see these really weird things that Bickerton does that really, like your question, he shows a lot of humility, and he gives other people power within his church, and he did at times monopolize power, but at other times he was very equal and egalitarian, and that gave him even more respect with his followers. But that also would cause problems for him later on as, you know, people try to take over. So, good question.
Is there any evidence that he approached or was approached by those from the Restoration Movement, the Reorganized and Community
of
Christ?
Yeah, that's a good question. He was approached by the Reorganized Church. He was approached by Stephen Post, who joined Sidney Rigdon's Second Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints of the Children of Zion. And basically, when Stephen Post comes and basically is like, listen, Sidney Rigdon sent me to try to gather all the Latter-day Saints together, and Bickerton's membership is like, oh no, there's another prophet that God has raised, and his name's William Bickerton, and you know, we don't accept Sidney Rigdon anymore. So that's a good question. And Bickerton, when they eventually go to Kansas and they try to create like a Zionic utopian like communal society in like St. John, Kansas. And they run into a lot of people. Bickerton actually, he never barred anybody from holding the priesthood, including African Americans. So, and that from the very, very beginning. And what's interesting, there's this really unique story to kind of ask your question. His last name was Burgess. I'm trying to remember his first name. It's in the book. I forget. But his last name is Burgess. He's a black man. He's an elder. And he's going around preaching in Missouri and in a lot of these slave states, or ex-slave states, because the Civil War had just ended. So, the wounds are still there. And there's this black minister preaching, and you actually see like people from the Reorganized Church and other people being like, there's this guy out here, and you know, he's preaching this doctrine from Bickerton, and he's causing a lot of ruckus because he's black. So it's interesting. So yeah, little stories here and there throughout the book about that.
So he didn't deny the priesthood to anyone?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, he never ordained women as elders, but he did from the very early beginning. It happened in 1863, I believe. Don't quote me, it's in the book, but I believe, yeah, it's 1863. He actually creates the office of a deaconess within his church because he finds scriptural precedent for that. And what's interesting is deaconesses had a lot of power and authority within Bickerton's church. They were allowed to lay hands on the sick with oil. And there are occurrences in Bickerton's minutes, you can take it for what it's worth, but I can show you the minutes, that they're actually lay hands on the sick with oil and these people are healed. So, I mean, it's really interesting. Bickerton never allowed women to hold the priesthood, but he allowed them to speak in conference. They, spoke in tongues and he had deaconesses at least.
So when Bickerton says, paraphrasing, I would rather incur the displeasure of God, he was kind of bluffing tongue-in-cheek, right?
Yeah.
he didn't mean it literally, like if this were of God or if it is of God, then I would or do choose to rebel against God. He meant instead, I believe this is not of God, and the Book of Mormon makes that abundantly clear. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I mean, it was very tongue-in-cheek and very sarcastic. Bickerton had a tendency to be sarcastic, and you can actually read that in his writings. He's kind of blunt quite a bit. So,
thank you.
No problem.
What's the structure now for regarding women and so forth?
Okay, regarding women now in the Church of Jesus Christ, there still are deaconesses. It's a little bit more traditional. The deaconesses set the communion table or the sacrament table in the meeting, and they visit the sick and they do things like that. They're allowed to pray, with any member, things like that. But they actually are not given the same exact. I mean, If a deaconess were to take the oil and lay hands on somebody, which I have heard of stories of them even in recent days doing this, that it just depends on who your presiding elder is. Presiding elder might just be like, all right, well, they're healed. So obviously God healed them. But if you get some more staunch traditionalists, that might be like, how dare you? But it just depends on who you talk to. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Okay. That's a good point.
So you mentioned that there was a man preaching in Missouri. So he sent out missionaries around the state.
Yeah.
What was the, did he send anybody to Utah? Was there any connection of him sending out missionaries trying to bring people, Utah Mormons, into his church as well?
Yes, that's an excellent question. Yes, there were some, Nauvoo members. I know of one specifically that I can at least quote one from the actual primary documentation. A Nauvoo member actually joins Bickerton's church, and she basically recalls a patriarch, I think it's a patriarchal blessing or some type of blessing she receives, where she would see the growth of Zion, and she says, oh, now that I'm a member of Bickerton Church, I see that happening. There is one place in the minutes where they do say that they want to send out missionaries to Utah, but I do not see anything else after that. They just say, let's do it, and then it's like, after that, you're like, well, did they do it? I have no idea. So that's a great question. That's lost to time and mystery. I would suspect they did, because what ends up happening is when they're in Kansas, there is this huge issue with Bickerton being accused of committing adultery. And it's pretty, there's not enough evidence to show that he did it, and most of his followers said he didn't do it. But there is this, basically, the church was infighting, basically. And it actually, Mormon elders, even all the way in Utah, heard about it, because there was some, you know, in the West in that area, and the news about this infighting in Bickerton's church actually went all the way up to John Taylor, and John Taylor heard about it and then sent some of his 70s and said, basically, let's go convert these people, and they were very successful at converting some of the members of Bickerton's church because of this infighting, and a lot of those people did move out to Utah, so there's a connection.
Hi. You mentioned that there was other people in the congregation that were also prophets, essentially. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about after Bickerton, like, was there a new prophet or leader of the church that claimed the mantle, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question. What ends up happening after the adultery allegation and scandal is the church literally splits in two. You have people who follow Bickerton, and you have people who follow this man known as William Cadman. And William Cadman considered himself a president. He was ordained a president. He was, you know, set aside by, like, the anointing of oil and being ordained as president. But I think he was the minutes kind of see that you can see he's kind of considered as a prophet, but he's never actually, or from what I've seen in the documentation, he's never actually ordained a prophet like Bickerton was. And Bickerton, and that's a good point. Let me stress this. Bickerton was ordained a prophet, but nobody else in his church was ordained a prophet. But they were considered prophets. And you might say, well, why is that the case? Well, the only way I can suspect, and from the documentation, is Bickerton was considered a prophet even before he was ordained a prophet. So it's like, well, they're calling him a prophet, but why did they ordain him and not everybody else? I think it was just a ceremonial idea of, like, saying, you are the president, prophet of the church, kind of like the original, you know, church presidency of the original Mormon church. And then after that, I think, you know, with prophets prophets in the Bible are almost never ordained. There's only one instance in the Bible where they're actually ordained, and it's when Elijah with the J anoints Elisha with oil as his successor. But every other prophet, you just see them show up by the Holy Spirit, and I think you can kind of see that that's how Bickerton saw it, as prophets and prophetesses, and even himself. So it was just a ceremonial ordination.
Just a comment and then a question. I had a similar experience, to Michael, meeting a member of the Church of Jesus Christ as a LDS missionary in Ohio. And it was very interesting and eye-opening dialogue, you know, to me as an LDS missionary, because, you know, if you look at their responses and there, you know, he had some literature that I kept and, keep on hand. But they talk a very, very, authoritatively about how do we decide whether something is doctrine or not. It's whether it conforms to the Word of God, which is Bible, Book of Mormon. Coming from a traditional LDS upbringing where you say, you know, the analogy of the two nails on a board that put something firmly in place, you know, it was eye-opening to me to say there are different interpretations, obviously, within the Book of Mormon, and if you look at the restoration movements, it's very clear. I guess my question is... They seem to maintain their faith base, you know, this person I was talking to, based on a, you know, revelatory experience. They talk about, you know, the Moroni 10:4, very much like an LDS, you know, pamphlet would. And I guess just looking from a, you know, a spiritual experience perspective, how do you view that the Church of Jesus Christ, you know, maintains a tradition, you know, because they're successful in promoting their religion, you know, to an upcoming generation. But also, as I understand the revelatory experience with their congregation, anyone can receive revelation, and there's also a, you know, kind of a large file kept of the revelations from members of their church that they keep. I'm just wondering how their tradition of promoting of the faith maybe contrasts with other you know, restoration movements, including Tradition of LDS.
Okay, thank you. That's a good question. I guess I can only speak. I can speak more authoritatively, I guess, on the Bickerton Church. Basically, what they do now, and it's different. Bickerton was much more. It was much more open back then. I mean, anybody can have it. But even to this day, anybody can have a revelation. But now, as the church has evolved, you know, we're in the 21st century. Anybody can have a revelation, but it's got to go through channels. So it doesn't matter if you're male, female. It doesn't matter how old you are. You can have a revelation. They have to write it down. Your presiding elder then has to basically say, okay, this is good. It then goes to, like, the region conference, and the region conference will look at it and say, oh, yeah, this is good. And then that will get sent to the apostles, and then the apostles will make the final decision, yes or no, and then they'll announce it, like, at, you know, one of their general conferences and say, like, okay, we received this revelation, and, you know, and this is what it says, and we accept it as a church. It's kind of like that. So they don't have the office of a prophet anymore. Now, that was only back in Bickerton's day. They got rid of that. They believe in prophets, but not ordaining them.
They rotate the 12.
Yeah, right. They have a presidency within the 12. So yeah, they'll have like a president, first and second counselor, and then yeah, after a certain amount of time, the president will either step down, and then they'll just rotate, or, you know, and just because you're the first counselor doesn't necessarily mean you'll become the president. You know, it could be anybody else, depending on how the apostles want to do it.
Sorry, I said
15. Oh, no. The Church of Jesus Christ did have 15 eventually. They got rid of that, I think, in the 1970s, and then they just went down to 12 apostles, and that's their highest office. Yes, did you have a question?
So you explained how this process happens. Does it happen?
Does it happen?
Are there any revelations?
Oh, yeah. Every year. Yeah. Some of them are accepted. Some of them aren't. Some of them are what they call tabled, meaning, like, you know, they'll just kind of put them to the side and see what happens. And they might be readdressed later on. Yeah. I'm sorry. None of this book goes into the new. It goes into the formation of it. That's for many of you to continue to research. And maybe I'll take it up later. But yeah. All right, thank you so much, and thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it.